need to repeat anything I've said. So the idea I want to discuss this sort of interface between practical and theoretical problems in the whole issue of predicting climate change, and to try to propose, I should say, at the end of the talk, a solution, which I think is one that will perhaps resonate or link up with some of the things which are more familiar to you in mainstream physics, let's say. So I'm going to keep that slightly obscure, exactly what I'm talking about, but hopefully it'll evolve through the talk. $1 trillion comes in a way from the Stern Review. Nick Stern is a well-known economist who did a report on the economics of climate change a year or two ago now, which has had very wide currency in the world, and he basically used a lot of the existing, like the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change reports about climate change, to give an indication about what is it going to mean to the world's economy, and a one sort of page summary of his report said that if we do nothing about climate change, it's going to cost the world about 5% of GDP each year. We can try to reduce greenhouse emissions to mitigate the worst impacts of climate change, and his estimate was that would be only about a 1% cost to GDP each year. So on the basis that 1% is less than 5%, we better go about trying to curb emissions. I'm not going to try to argue about the economics of this, but just to state those are the raw numbers. And if you take GDP at around $60 trillion, which it was the last time I looked on Google, but every time I watch television this week, it seems to be dropping. It's probably only about $1 trillion now, but at least when I wrote that, so 5% or 1% is still a $1 trillion problem. So that's one of the places where the $1 trillion comes in, but you'll see there's another place a little bit coming on. Now, these conclusions of Stern are obviously predicated on the fact that we can make predictions about climate change, what's going to happen in the future. And so, one could ask some pretty basic questions. Does it actually make sense to think that climate is predictable, that we can say something about what's going to happen in, say, the end of this century? Or if we do have models that can predict climate, can we trust them? Are they reliable, or are they just glorified video games, as some of the sort of climate skeptics sometimes claim? And perhaps even more practically, if we want to really try and nail down what's going to happen with more certainty than we currently are able, what are the impediments to trying to reduce uncertainty? Okay, so I thought I'd start with a couple of, in fact there'll be a few nice little animations just to relieve the tedium. This is a nice one of the Earth from space. So we're looking at a kind of mosaic of satellite observations of the Earth. It shows the very turbulent nature of the Earth's atmosphere. Interestingly, we're looking at the Earth in the infrared spectrum emitted by water vapor. And water vapor is the primary greenhouse gas in the atmosphere. Water vapor, so that's the gaseous form of water, is really the thing above anything else that keeps us warm and prevents us from freezing to death. And one of the difficulties about climate change prediction is actually trying to understand how increases in anthropogenic gases, carbon dioxide, will feed back on molecules like water vapor, thereby exacerbating or enhancing the greenhouse effect. Anyway, you see there, water vapor is a greenhouse gas, and it's a very complicated gas. It moves with the turbulent eddies in the atmosphere, and it's not particularly well-mixed gas in the atmosphere. The water vapor, in turn, comes in large part from the ocean surface. We're looking here, again, at a satellite picture over the Western Pacific Indonesian continent. By the way, you can see two nice tropical cyclones spinning up there. The real purpose, however, of this, showing this, is to point out these kind of boiling clouds, which are basically thunderstorm clouds, which are particularly prevalent over this part of the world, what we call deep convective clouds, the atmosphere is unstable thermally to these types of convective motions. You can see they release water in water droplets into the high atmosphere, evaporated from the sea surface. And in fact, the latent heating in these clouds is responsible for driving many of the atmospheric circulations that we see in the atmosphere. Okay, so there we go. If we look at a spectrum of the atmosphere, we see that it's characteristic of a turbulent fluid. This is a very famous historic picture, which has been confirmed many times, of the energy in the atmosphere as a function, essentially kinetic energy, if you like, as a function of wavelength, so 1,000 kilometers, 100, 10, 1 kilometer, and down to a tenth of a kilometer. And we see a drop-off in energy, initially dropping off fairly steeply, and then shallowing to a spectrum that is characteristic of what's called a Kolmogorov turbulent fluid. Most importantly, something I'll come back to, there's no spectral gap, there's no minimum between sort of large-scale atmospheric motions and, for example, these small-scale deep convective clouds. It's sort of part of a continuum. K to the minus 5.3 is an important scaling parameter. Okay, now one of the things which people sometimes say is that, how can you predict climate in a chaotic, if the atmosphere is chaotic? Doesn't that mean everything's unpredictable and hopeless? Well, one could easily dismiss that as an argument, and it allows me to pay tribute to a colleague of mine, Ed Lorenz, commonly referred to as the father of chaos theory, who died only a few months ago. He came up with this famous three-parameter, three-component equation, which is a kind of a simple distillation equations for convection in a fluid. Let's imagine we represent climate change by adding some additional term. This is a simple way of thinking about the effects of man's increasing atmospheric concentration of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. And what we'll do is just look at how the system responds to putting this additional term into the equations. So here's the original Lorentz model written as a time series of one of the variables, the X variable, and basically there are two kind of regimes. The two, if you know the attractor, what the attractor looks like, it looks like a butterfly. It's got these two lobes, two regimes, and you see the state kind of oscillating irregularly, chaotically between the two regimes. And with F equals zero, the two regimes are equally likely. There's a 50% chance, if you take any one snapshot in time, of the state lying in the lower regime or the upper regime. Well, we can crank up this F, this forcing parameter, and what you see is that the system stays chaotic. So if we took even this extreme situation here at time 150, we still wouldn't be able to predict with certainty where the state was, which of the two regimes the state lay in. But you can clearly see there's an impact of the forcing in terms of the probability distribution. There's a much higher probability of it being up here than down here. And as long as then we think in terms of changes to probability distributions of states rather than specific states, then we can certainly think of climate change as in principle, a predictable problem. And in fact, that is very much the way in which these days, again, looking, for example, at the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change's assessment reports, this is very much the way in which climate change predictions are presented. And I wanted to just give you a couple of examples of this in basically from the data that was in the latest IPCC assessment. So in this philosophy of thinking about probabilities, what we're doing here is illustrate. So I want to just run through a few examples about what the latest types of predictions are saying about climate change. So what we're looking at here, based on an ensemble of climate change integrations, we take an ensemble of models from around the world, started maybe from a range of initial states. to build up probability distributions of climate. What we're looking at here is the probability of exceeding the 95th percentile based on 20th century statistics. So you take in this case, you take a northern summer period, June to August, and based on 20th century statistic, you calculate the 95th percentile of seasonal mean temperature and say how often, based on the models now, how often will that be exceeded, or what's the probability of exceeding that as we move towards the end of this century. This is now based on the standard scenarios for increasing what is anticipated to be increasing levels of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere in the coming century. So what this slide shows is that in all these regions shaded, all the regions shaded red, what was in the 20th century a summer that would only occur with a 5% probability, so it was on that extreme of the probability distribution that it would only be one every 20 years, 5% chance, is occurring, well, pretty much every year. So that gives us a handle on, you know, in a probabilistic way, about the changes in probability of temperature at different parts of the world. I'm going to, just as I go through these slides, focus on particular regions. This was This illustrated on the abstract of my talk, and it illustrates one of the worrying feedbacks that as you melt, for example, the Arctic sea ice and expose the darker sea surface underneath, then that will actually exacerbate the warming through the increased absorption of sunlight by the water, which otherwise would have been reflected back to space by ice. Obviously, a major concern is the stability of the Greenland ice sheet as a result of all this warming. I think this remains extremely uncertain, but in the worst case scenario where it does disintegrate, then we have the problem of 7 or more meters of sea level rise to contend with. We can do the same sort of things now for precipitation, or rain and snowfall if you like, and again we're looking at June to August, what's the probability of exceeding the 95th percentile in terms of dry summers. So we're talking sort of droughts, how more frequent are droughts. We see now patterns which are much more sort of regional. Global warming, the temperature one was fairly uniform, there were a few blips showing regional detail, but when we come down to looking at precipitation patterns, then things are much more regional, and Europe, for example, is predicted to have a significantly increased probability of these sort of drought seasons, as indeed are parts of Central and maybe even South America. And that latter region is another cause for concern about feedbacks, because if the precipitation patterns change sufficiently to make the rainforest no longer sustainable, then we're talking about what was a major sink of carbon for the atmosphere becoming potentially a source of carbon, and therefore this whole thing is being driven by increased levels of carbon dioxide. So this is a worrying, again, another worrying potential positive feedback on climate change. And we can look at the opposite sign now of probability of exceeding the 95th percentile now of wet summers, so high rainfall summers, and again a very different pattern emerges. See, this was a region which was predicted to become dry, but now we get regions such as the Asian monsoon region where the monsoons may become significantly more intense under climate change. And then that raises, possibly with the additional problem of sea level rise, that maybe countries like Bangladesh might be largely unsustainable in the future, and the problem of substantial environmental refugeeism starts to rear its head. Okay, so it's a bit depressing, I'm afraid, but that's the kind of standard, these are the standard types of projections that the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change have been writing about in their assessment reports, and that's pretty much the state of science as we have it at the moment. Now, these predictions come from models which are essentially based on the laws of physics. This is the Navier-Stokes equation. There are similar equations for the laws of thermodynamics, mass continuity equation, so on. We don't have to worry about relativistic effects. We do, in a sense, have to worry about quantum mechanical effects, because the whole issue of radiation is, and the greenhouse effect is essentially quantum mechanical. So in the thermodynamic equations, there would be representations of the infrared and ultraviolet parts of the spectral absorbers in the atmosphere. But I'm just going to focus, for this purpose of this talk, just using that Navier-Stokes equation as a kind of paradigmatic equation for the type of equations we used in our models. Incidentally, both weather forecast and climate models have a very similar pedigree and heritage. They're sort of, and increasingly these days, they're becoming largely interchangeable. The problem, of course, is we can't exactly integrate these equations. They describe a turbulent fluid with scales of motion from tens of thousands of kilometers down to millimeters. We can't integrate the whole thing, so typically what happens is you put this into some sort of Galerkin basis of grid points, or in the case of my own institute, spherical harmonics, and we represent things accurately down to scales. Well, for a climate model, typically about 100 kilometers at present. So if you had a grid point type model, the grid points would be about 100 kilometers or so apart, maybe a bit more. But then there are many processes below the 100 kilometer scale that we cannot represent explicitly, but they are important. And I mentioned about water vapor being an important greenhouse gas. Clouds are then critically important for describing the distribution of water vapor and indeed liquid water in the atmosphere. But cloud systems are typically much smaller. This is a schematic of one of those thunderstorm clouds I showed you in the satellite photo. We looked at it from above. But here it is, sucking up moist air from the sea surface, precipitating out. So a lot of complicated dynamics going on there. But only over a scale of a few tens of kilometers, less than the spacing of our grid points. So we have to do something about representing that in the models. There's also effects of unresolved topography, flow over unresolved topography, small-scale turbulence in the boundary layer, flow over trees and all sorts of buildings and everything like that, which is responsible for transporting heat and moisture up from the surface up into the free atmosphere. So what is typically done is to come up with what's often called a parametrization. It's kind of loosely based on ideas in statistical mechanics of, you imagine, an ensemble of small-scale cloud systems, and you try to represent in a simple formula, could be a sort of diffusive-like formula, for these cloud systems, but the formula is driven by resolved variables, typically at the truncation scale, and these three parameters which modelers try to fit using observations and what data is available. So, for example, if you have a temperature profile, if your grid box over Indonesia is, the temperature in the vertical is such as to be convectively unstable, then the parametrization will kick in. So convectively unstable means you look at the temperature and the humidity at that grid, in that grid box, and if it's unstable to small perturbations, then this parametrization will kick in, and basically it will adjust the temperature and humidity profile back towards some sort of convective neutrality. And in doing so, it will produce a certain amount of latent heat release that will then feed into the atmospheric scales and so on. And there are other types of these parametrization formulae for other processes. Now, this is a very much an empirical formula. It's not something which is an immediate consequence of these equations. It's something which is a kind of necessary evil to close the equations and represent effects which we know, in a sense, are important for climate, but we can't resolve them. Well, here's another couple of nice animations. Here is now we're looking down into a computer, if you like, rather than down from space, and we're seeing what a numerical model makes of the atmosphere. And it does, you can see it sort of in a sort of visual way, it does a nice job at simulating the turbulent motion, the weather patterns as they propagate from west to east and so on and so forth. And if we were to focus on our region over the western Pacific, you start to see now the granularity of the model, the fact it isn't a continuum, it's not solving continuum equations, but very much discrete equations. It can sort of spin up tropical cyclones, as you see here, but it looks very much like a sort of pointillist painting, I think, of the real world rather than the real world itself, and that is a direct consequence of this truncation and parametrization process that goes on. Okay, well, if I was giving a talk to, maybe a group of government officials, I think I'd probably stop at this point. But I kind of want to, since we're all friends here, right? no climate skeptics in the audience, I hope. Raise your hand now if you are, because I might give a different talk. See, somebody's assiduously taking notes. You're not a reporter, are you? No. Yes, he is. Okay. Because there is a problem here, and that is that these models, impressive as they are and nice as they look in these animations, they do, in some respects, are not a terribly good job at simulating the 20th century climate. We have data, obviously. We know what the temperatures, the winds, rainfall patterns, humidities, and so on are. And when we run our models in with 20th century values of carbon dioxide and look at the accuracy of the simulations, we typically see that these models have biases. And these biases in most models, I would say, are as large as the climate change signals the models are trying to predict. So this is just to give you an example, I mean, this is a typical sort of picture. If you took an observed a probability distribution of temperature at some point on the Earth's globe and looked at, say, seasonal mean temperature over the 20th century, you'd get some sort of a Gaussian distribution. These would be the terciles, so this is a 33% of the area lies below the lower tercile. And then you do the same thing for the models, and you ask how much lies below, say, the observed tercile. Well, it's not, unfortunately, 33%. It's, in many cases, much different to 33%. This is actually a plot of that type of problem, and you see there are many areas where the area below the observed lower tercile can actually be as much as 70%. So there's a real issue here that the models do have significant biases, and we want to try to improve their accuracy. Well, how would we do that? Well, in a sense, we know from experiments that we do that these biases are certainly sensitive to the parameterizations. And if you look in detail, the problem is not so much that, we don't quite know what the right value of, say, that those alpha parameters are. It's more that the whole concept of the bulk formula parameterization is itself a questionable assumption. If you remember, I showed you right at the beginning of the talk that spectral slope of atmospheric variability with no spectral gap between the things that we want to simulate, the large-scale aspects we want to simulate, and the small-scale things that we have to parameterize. If we were really in a statistical mechanics type of paradigm, we would say, okay, there's an enormous difference between the mean free path of a molecule and the macro scale that we're trying to, that we're actually interested in. For these atmospheric problems, there is no such sort of scale separation. There's just this continuum, and in fact rather shallow decrease in energy as we go from big scales to small scales. So the problem really is that and perhaps you got a sense of that, I don't know, when I showed you the animation, almost right at the beginning of the talk, the animation of the those tropical thunderstorms. You know, if you were to take a small grid box of typically 100 kilometers square, you wouldn't see 100 thunderstorms and a micro canonical ensemble of thunderstorms within that 100 kilometer box. You'd only see one or two at the most, three or four at the very most. So what this is really doing is in some sense casting some doubt or problems on this methodology, which is the one used around the world, I should say, of closing the equations of motion in a discretized system that we have to have to solve the equations computationally. Well, okay, so the standard answer to that question would be, okay, well, let's try to run our models instead of 100 kilometers at a much higher resolution. So let's push this truncation scale down to yet more, down to scales, maybe 1 kilometer instead of 100. And then we're not going to be worried so much about how to represent thunderstorms, because now those will be, let's say, reasonably well simulated. But we will still have to close the equations, and there will still be processes that will have to be described in some approximate way. These processes will now be down to sort of the subcloud physics, what's sometimes called microphysics, of how individual droplets and ice crystals and things behave within the cloud. But the thought will be by pushing the uncertainty about the parametrization process down to very small scales, we've sort of somehow, swept the problem under the carpet. That's the hope. And the question is that really true? By the way, here's a very nice animation of a 1 kilometer model done, in fact, at the Canadian Environment Canada, Canadian Met Service, showing a weather system evolving. This is over the Gulf of Mexico, and it looks indeed truly a kind of beautiful, I think, animation. The problem is that with current computers, to run this model 100 years to get a forecast for 2100 would probably take about 200 years. And this sort of casts doubt on the usefulness of that. But in any case, we can ask the question, maybe we should be pressing for bigger computers to be able to run models at 1 kilometer resolution, so it doesn't take 100 years, but maybe it takes a shorter time. So high resolution, which is the sort of standard a standard climate modeler's response to what are you going to do about these biases that we have in the current generation of models. High resolution would certainly allow more scales of motion to be represented by the things like the Navier-Stokes equations, what I call the proper laws of physics, rather than by empirical parametrization. And as an additional benefit, we'd certainly get things that we know well, like the topography of the Earth's surface and the land-sea, the boundary between land and sea, much better represented. So there's potentially a lot going for what would be called the brute force approach to trying to reduce these biases. But as I say, there is a fundamental problem here that if you reduce, say, by an order of magnitude the resolution of a model, you have to think really to be consistent of reducing it in both of the horizontal directions. And, well, really to be consistent, you probably want to increase the resolution in the vertical direction. And then you've got the time step to worry about. You've got to reduce the time to prevent numerical instability. You've got to reduce the time step. So actually a decrease by an order of magnitude in resolution converts into something like 10 to the power 4 in computer cost. So really, we're talking about computers that just do not, certainly do not exist at the national level anywhere in the world. And a group of people, I mean, I've been involved myself, have been talking about, for example, you know, just the other week, we've had the Large Hadron Collider being switched on. Marvelous example of international science, doing the sort of science that can't be done at the national level. Maybe we need something like CERN, for climate prediction, to invest in sort of high-performance computing that just couldn't be afforded at national level. And that's, I think, a great concept. But if one actually got to the stage of interesting governments to fund such an international center, I'm sure the first question they will ask is, well, okay, we'll give you this computer, but just tell us how much more accurate will your simulations be? How much will you be able to reduce these biases if you run climate models at 1 kilometer rather than 100 kilometers. And this is where the right-hand side of my initial slide comes into play. And at first sight, this seems a very abstruse problem in mathematics. But I'm going to just run you through it in a rather sort of simpler way. And what it relates to is a thing which I'm calling the real butterfly effect. And I use the word real because almost always people use the term butterfly effect in a way in which Lorentz himself did not imply to be meant. We normally these days think of the butterfly effect as just describing the growth of small-scale errors and perturbations of a chaotic system. It's just another word for chaotic dynamics. And in a chaotic system, such as the Lorentz three-component model, if you reduce the error to zero, if you reduce the amplitude to zero, then you can make predictions as long ahead as you want. It's a deterministic system. The solution depends completely at any time into the future. The solution depends continuously on the initial error, and as the error goes to zero, so the solution goes to the truth solution. But Lorentz didn't really mean this. He wasn't talking about this when he talked about the butterfly effect. He was actually referring to a type of behavior which seems to be a feature of the three-dimensional Navier-Stokes equations. And this is he wrote a paper 6 years after his famous 63 paper, which elucidates this in a simple model context for Lorentz. So he took a truncation of the Navier-Stokes equations, but this truncation had many scales of motion. It was a multi-scale system. And this figure here sort of illustrates the feature that was found in that model. What we're looking at here are scales going from tens of thousands of kilometers down to fractions of a kilometer. And what we're going to do is we have a model, and we'll introduce a small error at initial time. Now, this error is small in two ways. It's small in amplitude, but it's also small in scale. So let's imagine we had, for example, the errors on the scale of 1 kilometer. But everything above 1 kilometer, there were no errors. What these lines here show are the sort of fronts of error, how long it takes the error to propagate up the spectrum of motion to larger and larger scales. So, you know, let's say after an hour, the error has gone up to almost 40 kilometers. A day, it's gone up to a couple of thousand kilometers. And after 5 days, 10,000 kilometers. This line here is the kind of saturation of error. It saturates due to the nature of the equations. But the most important thing is this increase in the time scale at which these errors propagate up. Okay, now, so 5 days, we've got to 10,000 kilometres. You might imagine, if we want to delay the onset of this error to, say, 10 days or 20 days or a year or something, we would just put the error, confine the error to smaller and smaller scales. We'll let just, if we could reduce, just imagine this as a measuring problem. You have an error at 1 kilometer and it takes 5 days. You might say, okay, I'm going to bombard the atmosphere with thermometers and barometers to measure every 100 meters or every 10 meters very, very accurately. So now your error is less than 10 meters. How much do you delay the onset of the error at 10,000 kilometers? The answer is not a jot, nothing, zilch. There is a fundamental non-convergence here of error as the scale of the error goes to zero. And this was recognized, this problem. Now, Lorentz did the study in an idealized model. It wasn't a rigorous analysis of the Navier-Stokes equations. And the problem essentially appeared then in rigorous form in the set of mathematics problems which the Clay Mathematics Institute put out at the turn of the millennium. This is mirroring the famous Hilbert problems of mathematics at the onset of the 20th century. And indeed, I guess things like the Riemann hypothesis was certainly one of Hilbert's original problems, and there are many famous mathematics problems which I guess this one has been solved now, but there are other ones which are very famous. But here we are, the Navier-Stokes equations are one of those millennium problems. So you win yourself $1 million if you can solve this problem, although what I want to say is that actually this problem has implications for climate change, and so perhaps you really should be winning $1 trillion if you believe the Stern analysis of climate change. The problem in true mathematical form is extremely obscure to people who are not well versed in these things, and I don't think the physical implications of this problem are at all obvious if you were to read this. Basically what it says is, here are the Navier-Stokes equations. If you start with smooth initial conditions and you have some sort of boundary conditions, I mean they could be periodic boundary conditions or some suitably regular boundary conditions, you don't need anything funny on the boundaries. The question is, do there exist smooth bounded solutions at all times? And as I say, this kind of seems, what's that got to do with anything? That's extremely boring. But basically what it's about, well, as it is stated, it's about, is there a finite time downward cascade of energy from large scales to small scales? So in other words, if you initialized the fluid just with large scales only, could you, in finite time, generate arbitrarily small scales, which would then lead some of the derivatives to blow up, and so you wouldn't get smoothness anymore, at finite time. And put that way, you can perhaps see, and I think one, you know, if I had time, I could sort of run through this a bit more, but I won't do it in the presence of time, is to say this is very closely related to Lorentz's real butterfly effect, which is now not so much about the downward propagation of energy, or the downward cascade of energy in finite time, but the upward cascade of error in finite time to large scales from arbitrarily small scales. Now what this means in practical language is that if this problem is true, then moving our parametrization error from cloud scales to subcloud scales may actually not improve the simulation by as much as we would like, because even though we've moved the problem down to sub-kilometer scales, the effects of the errors in the bulk formula approach will still come up and hit us with the same severity as they would do if our truncation scale had been at a much coarser resolution. So this just comes to the last few minutes of my talk, which is really what I wanted to talk about, which is an alternative method, and this is the sort of thing that I'm very much interested in and have been trying to promote in the last few years. And for, I have to say, for climate modellers, this is a bit of a paradigm shift, and it's not one that they're terribly comfortable with, but I think is one that is going to be important for the future. And that is, we really need to be getting away from the whole concept of the bulk formula parameterization, and indeed towards a much more explicitly stochastic representation of the equations of motion that we use in our models. And so what my group and myself have been working on over the years is replacing these bulk formulae with actually sort of computationally cheap stochastic dynamic equations. And these would not be trying to represent some sort of ensemble of you know, microstates, an ensemble mean of microstates within a grid box, but specific realizations of subgrid processes. I'm conscious of the time. I have to finish at 5, do I? Okay, so I'm just going to pass this over. One can show with rather simple models, this is another one of Lorentz's models, that this idea works very well. I'm sorry, I'm going to pass this over because I'll take up a little bit too much time. But one can do, basically, one can do simple idealized models to demonstrate that under circumstances stochastic parameterizations can work well. One approach which I've been very keen on is the use of cellular automata. Here's a kind of a snapshot of a model that we have. So in our grid box here, this will be the 100 kilometer grid box. We actually have a cellular automaton model running in the background. It's driven by the grid scale flows. It's supposed to represent in simple ways convective type of clouds and organization. A development of this has been actually to use the icing model, which I guess some of you, I'm